Is Canada acting even more aggressively in favor of war in Ukraine than the United States is? Are Canada and the other great nations commemorating D-Day actually using the event as propaganda against Russia? Could recent escalations between NATO and Russia evolve either deliberately or accidentally into World War III? Is BRICS Plus evolving into a legitimate alternative to the standard US-backed Bretton Woods order that can work to the advantage of various sectors in the Global South? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with tensions building as President Putin warns of actions against NATO countries if Ukraine strikes deep into Russian territory with Western weapons, we are considering the prospects of this two-year-long Ukraine fight exploding onto the global stage, possibly into a nuclear confrontation. In our first half hour, we speak with activist and author Yves Engler about Canada's role in the ongoing escalations and of his upcoming book, Correcting the Record of Canada Against and Not For Democracy Abroad. Then in our final half hour, we chat with former CIA analyst Larry Johnson about the dangerous path to a NATO-Russia war we are on. And we also speak about his recent attendance at the St. Petersburg International Forum a week ago and about what he heard on the ground from Land of the Bear. On this week's program, Cuban Missile Crisis Revisited, the U.S., Canada, and NATO provoking World War III. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 14th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. Just like the way racialized countries throughout the world can continue under colonization despite being liberated from Western control, so Indigenous people continue under colonization in spite of visible efforts at reconciliation. May the current generation root out their own generation's long habits and attitudes and listen attentively to what continues to plague a respectful partnership which we hope to establish. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Israel will agree to a ceasefire as long as it has, quote, the freedom to keep fighting, unquote. Huh? In case you're wondering, the definition of, quote, unquote, ceasefire is, quote, a suspension of fighting, unquote. Therefore, we must assume that if the fighting continues, there is no ceasefire. By the way, Hamas has already agreed to the terms of the ceasefire, which is another blow to Blinken's crazy plan to try to make Israel look like the peacemaker. That comes from the article Biden's Ceasefire Fiasco by Mike Whitney, posted June 13th, originally published on the UNS Review. John F. Kennedy stood firm and the missiles were withdrawn, but this month, after some years of closer cooperation between Moscow and Havana, a group of ships of the Russian Navy has arrived in Cuba. They include the frigate Admiral Gorshkov, as well as the nuclear submarine Kazan, which is capable of carrying Zircon hypersonic missiles. The Biden administration's decision to allow Ukraine to use long-range U.S. weapons to target Russian territory to defend the Kharkov area is causing Russia to counter by targeting the American Strategic Reconnaissance UAV RQ-4 Global Hawk operating in the Black Sea. They, together with NATO AWACS aircraft, have provided constant reconnaissance for the guidance of NATO missiles targeted at Crimea and the Zaporizhzhia region by NATO forces in the name of Ukraine. Such U.S. military decisions could lead to a dangerous escalation and the prospect of direct Russian-American military confrontation. That comes from the article, The Madness of War. Another Cuban Missile Crisis? USA and France Court Global War. Rodney Atkinson. By Rodney Atkinson. Posted June 13th. Originally published on Free Nations. Via Journal of Clinical Child and Adolescent Psychology, emphasis added, quote, approximately 1 in 9 U.S. children have ever received an ADHD diagnosis, 11.4%, 7.1 million children, and 10.5%, or 6.5 million, had current ADHD. Among children with current ADHD, 58.1% had moderate or severe ADHD, 77.9% had at least one co-occurring disorder. Approximately half of children with current ADHD, or 53.6%, received ADHD medication, and 44.4% had received behavioral treatment for ADHD in the past year. Nearly one-third, or 30.1%, did not receive any ADHD-specific treatment. Pediatric ADHD remains an ongoing and expanding public health concern, as approximately 1 million more children had ever received an ADHD diagnosis in 2022 than in 2016, unquote. I'm going to go out on a limb here and predict the prescribed solution to runaway childhood ADHD and autism is going to be new patented wonder drugs that the corporate state media will dutifully tout heavily until some serious side effects discovered years down the road lead to their recall. That comes from the article, Autism and ADHD Rates Explode. Public Health, TM, Establishment Shrugs, by Ben Barty, posted June 13th, originally published on the author's Substack, Armageddon Prose. While they are arresting peace activists for exercising First Amendment rights, they are making plans to host Netanyahu, a war criminal, with an actual arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court. For decades, people following Code Pink's lead have been protesting inside the halls of Congress. The year before October 7th, there were a handful of us protesting the bloated military budgets and the U.S. warmongering. I was arrested several times on my own, but since October, dozens of us have been arrested in Congress, hundreds in D.C., and thousands across the U.S. and the world for Palestine. The sustained energy and activism are the result of the 40,000 plus thousands of Palestinians murdered, millions being starved and displaced, their land, water, and air poisoned, and neighborhoods, hospitals, schools, and refugee camps demolished. That comes from the article, They're Arresting the Wrong People Inside U.S. Congress, by Olivia DiNucci, posted June 13th.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
So with me is Eve Engler. He is one of Canada's leading
foreign policy critics and the author of 13 books, his latest being Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. He joins us now to talk about where Canada stands with regard to the latest escalations in the Ukraine war. A pleasure hosting you again, Yves. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, there's a recent escalation in the war early last week. The US is agreeing to allow the launch of US missiles from Ukraine territory aimed deep into Russia. And of course, President Putin made statements to the effect that escalations by the US and NATO could have, quote, serious consequences, unquote. So that seems a little bit disturbing. As far as you know, is Canada playing any kind of a moderating influence, or is it actually intensifying the hawkishness of the situation? What is your read?
They are very clearly, explicitly intensifying the conflict. Before Biden came out and made the agreed to the using U.S. weapons in Russia, which is a little bit of a complicated thing because the Ukraine was already bombing in, doing different attacks within Russia. But this was a more explicit endorsement of the employment of U.S. weapons. But in the lead up to that, of course, the French government was pushing a more hawkish position, calling for NATO troops, and had agreed similarly with the U.K. for U.S. For their weapons to be used. And Melanie Joly, about 2 days, 3 days before Biden made his declaration, Melanie Joly, Canada's foreign minister, publicly stated that Canadian weapons could be used in Russia. Some people speculated that the other countries, some other NATO countries making the announcement in advance was all kind of coordinated with Washington. It was sort of Washington preferred to be the last country or latter country in declaring explicitly that their weapons could be used in Russia. But for, certainly Julie has enhanced that dynamic. And it's important for people to realize that there is a whole series of measures taking place that are dangerous escalation. I think maybe the most important one is the fact that Ukrainian fired at Russia's early warning nuclear system. And I don't fully understand the technical side to this, but there's experts in this field that basically are pointing out that this is really, adds to the tension, adds to the danger. It makes it so Russian officials would have far less time to react to a potential U.S. Or other nation firing nuclear weapons at it. I think drops the time from like something like 18 minutes down to like 5 or 6 minutes of warning time, which just puts everything on one step up in a danger situation. And the fact that basically the Russians are increasingly blind to recognizing whether there is rockets being fired or missiles being fired by the U.S. towards, principally Moscow. So I think, a dangerous escalation. Obviously, all the other rhetoric and the discussion around putting NATO troops in, and you had a number of the Baltic countries going on that. You have, of course, French President Macron, who's been beating that drum for a couple months now. And then you have the Americans and other countries saying, yeah, go ahead and fire into Russia with our weapons. That's a it's all a dangerous escalation. And it's obviously, of course, on the other side, Moscow is pounding, destroying the whole electricity grid within Ukraine. So they are also, of course, pursuing what is, in essence, a quite a brutal military strategy. I think part of the NATO reaction and the sort of escalatory dynamic that NATO is pursuing is because Russia is steadily gaining and steadily winning, and The economic sanctions have been a failure. And in response to that, the Canadian government really is right at the center of pushing this process of stealing the Russian assets and basically handing them over to Ukraine. And that's being all kind of negotiated right now with the G7. And Canada's foreign minister, finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, has been a real aggressive proponent of that. That goes back right after the Russian invasion, and has continued to push that. And there's a number of stories about that in recent weeks. So kind of at all fronts, we're seeing a escalating dynamic that, of course, the Russians have been doing some exercises with tactical nuclear weapons. You're hearing more of this kind of rhetoric coming out of Russian officials, Russian media around the red lines and the nuclear weapons. And then on the other side, you have this sort of Biden and other NATO officials steadily crossing what are their, has stated their own kind of red lines and not escalating the war. So the conflict has kind of been a bit put off the front burner in terms of the media part because of the horrors in Gaza. But I think we're pursuing a path of further escalation that's very, very troubling.
Yeah. Let's go back to last week. There was the big ceremony celebrating D-Day. And understandably, we're commemorating the soldiers who gave their all to fight the Nazis. But there were some unusual moments, like seeing Zelensky. I won't say President Zelensky because he wasn't actually, didn't stand for a re-election again. He's just occupying it. But he was quite frankly working with the Nazis in this battle, as we've detailed on this show. But he was honored with a warm embrace by a veteran who was fighting the Nazis. And then there was Mr. Trudeau talking about the pivotal role of the soldiers that they played during the war, but made sure to mention that World War II situation reflects the dangers of today in a world plagued by authoritarian governments, misinformation, disinformation, and so on. But basically referring to Russia, who was not honored at all at this fighting off on the East Front. But ironically, the leaders here seem to want us to remember, but remember in a certain way. Don't remember the role of the Russians. So we're both saluting heroes and promoting war, it seems. I don't know. Could you expand on the significance, both positive and negative, of this 80th anniversary event?
Well, obviously, the Soviet Union's role in defeating the Nazis is not being discussed, even though it was central. You have a dynamic, I think, that you're pointing out that there's a it's a little bit troubling that the some of the forces Ukraine that are clearly neo-Nazi, that have a history of participating in the Nazi forces during World War II, the SS, that they are sort of now kind of rehabilitated into actually being the sort of anti-Nazi forces. I think that what the Canadian media and the politicians are doing with their celebrations is they are presenting Canada as this a force for democracy and a force for good. I think ultimately in World War II, unlike basically every other war that Canada's participated in, World War II is ultimately justifiable. And so we did actually ultimately do something good. There's a lot of things we did in the lead up to it and during the war that weren't good and that weren't really about fighting fascism. If you look at the background to World War II, Canada was actually pretty pretty okay with the fascist forces in Spain and Italy and even in Germany, but ultimately it was a positive endeavor. All the other wars Canada's participated in, that's not the case. They aren't justifiable, in my opinion, essentially in any way. They're setting up. There is a drumbeat towards hypermilitarism, increasing military spending. There's increasingly discussion of conscription. Globe and Mail, National Post, even the Toronto Star have published recent stories calling for the possibility of bringing in conscription. And all of this is basically laying the groundwork for a great power conflict. Principally, how they're framing it now is with Russia over Ukraine. But underlying that, of course, is probably the more important a conflict that the empire is setting up, which is with China. And so the framing, of course, in all this is, we are the forces of democracy and they are the forces of authoritarianism. Meaning Russia, China, Iran, and whoever's our enemy is by definition the forces of authoritarianism. This of course is a very simplistic, ahistoric kind of look at things. And if you look at how, as my recent co-authored book, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy shows, Canada has consistently worked to undermine, overthrow elected governments. So the notion that we're about trying to advance democracy is kind of hard to believe. But I think that's what this commemoration of D-Day is about, hyping up martial patriotism, laying the groundwork for this notion that, we need to get serious about our security, as they would frame it. We need to put more resources. We have to get to the 2% of GDP target for military spending that NATO had just sort of created out of thin air. We might even have to bring in conscription, all because the elites want to, first of all, weaken Russia, but ultimately, I think more importantly to them is trying to constrain China's rise. So I think that's really where we should understand this sort of the recent celebrations of D-Day.
Okay. In our last few minutes, you're in Victoria right now, and you're promoting your recent book that you mentioned with Owen Chalk on Canada's long fight against democracy. What is so far on your tour? How are the people responding given the current events happening in Europe and also in the Russia-Ukraine front?
Well, I think people are they are taken aback. First of all, most people, even people on the left who pay attention to foreign policy, haven't really kind of thought through the fact that Canada has been involved in nearly two dozen coups over the past 60 or 70 years. I think the power of the book is not some sort of massive revelation, but in fact, it's to bring together this pattern of Canada. We detail 22 different coups where Canada either passively or actively participated. And I think that's something that's just completely outside of bounds in any sort of a mainstream discussion of Canadian foreign policy, even though the details that we bring forward, I don't think there's almost very few of which anyone would really contest. They would say, somebody who's somewhat serious investigator would say, okay, yeah, these facts are more or less true. In fact, there's many more details in each case study that we present that you could marshal to make the case. But they would still repeat that, you know, Canada is a force for democracy, which is, of course, a ridiculous claim that, you know, on one hand, we consistently support actively, even and sometimes quite actively, as is in the case of Venezuela in recent years, or Aristide in Haiti in 2004, or Yanukovych in 2014 in Ukraine. We aggressively engage in efforts to overthrow elected governments. But we can still claim the mantra of promoting democracy. I think the other thing that's going on is that the horrors of what's happening in Gaza, and Canada's enabling this what really is, you know, basically a Holocaust in Gaza. Canada's role in doing that and people seeing that play out over the past 8 months is that it's very much undermined this notion of benevolent Canada. It's put into question many people who had kind of bought into the NATO proxy war and believing that Canada was in fact trying to defend Ukrainian sovereignty or defend democracy, you know, against Russia. Now, when they've seen 8 months of Canadian officials justify what is clearly, clearly unjustifiable taking place in Gaza, I think that's put into question Canadian foreign policy more generally. So thus far, when I've been doing my events, I've actually had kind of surprisingly good turnouts in these different, often smaller communities, to hear this message of, in fact, Canada is not this benevolent force internationally. In fact, it works regularly to undermine democracy, no matter the human consequence.
Yeah, I know that you're often referred to as the Canadian equivalent of Noam Chomsky. I mean, he's a, you know, very bright guy, but he's critical of his own nation, and of course, he doesn't get any media. How is your experience with mainstream media lately? Has it become even worse than it was?
Yeah, it's gotten to the point where it's down to basically zero. The only attention that's ever basically is negative. There was a pretty aggressive smear campaign from the Journal de Montréal, which did about a year and a bit ago, basically said I was just a Russian agent because I challenged Canadian politicians on issues from Venezuela to Haiti to climate to obviously the NATO proxy war. In fact, it was so absurd that in their pictures to online photos for the smear piece saying I was a Russian agent, they actually had images from me and a member of the Haitian community back in 2019 challenging Melanie Joly around Canada's role in Haiti. It's, you know, basically comical, but so it's either complete ignoring or you know, marginalizing and just totally uninterested to hear my perspective. And the very rare times when there's any attention, it's to say that, you know, I'm an agent of Russia, or at different points it's been an agent of China or an agent of Iran or an agent of Hamas or an agent of Venezuela. In fact, even going back 20 years, people were saying I was funded by Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the ousted president of Haiti. But the mainstream discussion on Canadian foreign policy is absolutely completely controlled. There's a very minimal perspective allowed. The range of debate is just absolutely outrageous. Fortunately, the dominant media is, you know, weakening, and there's more and more other outlets to get our perspective out. The big media is really a total joke on foreign policy, particularly.
Yeah, and in just in a minute, I mean, can you tell us anything more about the trip? I mean, you're moving eastward, right? You're going to end up in Winnipeg on June 20th.
Yeah, I'm on the island. I'm doing an event in Victoria this evening, and then Kelowna, Calgary, Regina, and Winnipeg over the next 10 days or so.
Okay, well, I guess we'll look forward to seeing you then, Yves. So thanks, and take care, and I guess good luck with the next few days of talks.
Thank you.
You've been speaking with Yves Engler. He's an author and an activist. If you want more details about his book or about the various locations that he's going to be visiting over the next few days, visit yvesengler.com.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
The war in Ukraine is so far turning in favor of Russia, according to leading analysts. And the response on the part of NATO leaders like Joe Biden is apparently to double down on their own hawk-like involvement in the war. I mean, the U.S. president issued a directive allowing Ukraine to use weapons sent there to not only attack invading targets fighting in Ukraine, but also those deep inside Russia. And the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, warned that Russia would provide long-range weapons to others to strike Western targets in response to attacks by NATO on Russian territory. And he reaffirmed the use of nuclear weapons if he sees a threat to the country's sovereignty. The Western leaders seem to be playing a game of chicken and are fairly convinced that Russia will blink. Should we have faith in their confidence? Joining me to discuss these developments in the Ukraine war, we're joined once again by Larry Johnson. Larry C. Johnson is a veteran of the CIA and the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. He's the founder and managing partner of Berg Associates, which was established in 1998. Larry provided training to the U.S. military's Special Operations Community for 24 years. He's also active as a member of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which advises U.S. presidents and the public about intelligence not being heeded by policymakers. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, Larry.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be with you.
So there have been a number of escalations from the side of NATO, and Russia has responded in similar terms. I mean, just recently, a group of Russian ships, including a nuclear-powered submarine, arrived in Cuba earlier today. What are your thoughts about these recent trends towards escalation?
Well, a lot of times people are reading into events such as the arrival of the Russian ships, perhaps a little more than is there. And what I mean by that, that trip was planned out, some time ago. They just didn't decide last week, hey, we're going to Cuba, we're going to show those Americans. Part of it is the West reading into it and trying to actually portray a threat that's not there. For example, they said, the Russian submarine is off the coast of Miami. Well, yeah, there's been a Russian submarine off the coast of the United States, the East Coast, West Coast, last 50 years, 60 years. We need to sort of step back from that kind of alarmism. Now, that said, you're absolutely right about the rhetoric of the West in terms of these threats that they're going to ramp up and basically encouraging Ukraine to strike deeper into Russia. Although, Biden said they put some restraints on it. They can only hit around Belgorod. Well, the reality is Ukraine has been attacking the people, the civilians in Belgorod for more than a year. So that's not like that's new. I think the real issue would be whether they were going to be able to launch any kind of effective attacks deeper inside Russia. And to that extent, the Russians definitely put the world on notice, both Vladimir Putin, Sergei Lavrov, and the deputy foreign minister, Sergei Rybkov, all have said very, very clearly that that the escalation of the West is foolish, it will be met with force, and that Russia will do anything that it needs to do to protect itself. And those in the West that think that Putin is bluffing or he's weak are making a fatal mistake, or at least potentially fatal if they keep it up. Because I don't think, Russia's not trying to escalate this into a massive nuclear war. But and you know, the reality is the West is weak. The West doesn't have the military capability to carry through on these threats. We're deluding ourselves. I mean, for goodness sake, you've got the British Army can barely maintain a strength of 70,000, which is nothing. You know, that's the Russians have killed that many Ukrainians in the last 2 months. And so, you know, the British don't have anything to offer. Neither do the French. The French have very limited military capability. The U.S. Army total for worldwide, 452,000 is the last number I saw. Compare that with Russia. Russia's got 1.3 million troops. So three times the size of what the United States is fielding. But go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if, I mean, you've heard from what the politicians are saying, but I mean, you also have contacts within the military. And I'm just wondering, is there a significant difference in the way they relate the actions on the ground versus the way the politicians are? Because I don't know, it seems like the military tend to have a more, you know, practical and an understanding of what's going on. So what is their
I'd say they're equally delusional.
Really?
The ones that have their heads screwed on straight, that recognize how dangerous this escalation is, are generally sidelined. They're not the voices that are listened to. They're shunted aside. So what you know, you've got really the blind leading the blind in this case. They keep insisting that they can you know, bully Russia, and they can't. You know, Russia has, you know, has done one thing that the United States has never done, and that it's defeated foreign powers that have invaded. I guess you could say we didn't really defeat. We beat the British at the Battle of New Orleans in 1815, but that was because a peace agreement had already been signed. So other than that, you know, the United States has lived in a sheltered life, frankly, as have the Canadians, and never faced invading armies and losing millions of citizens to those invading armies.
Wow.
So, you know, you look at what Russia endured with first the invasion by Napoleon, 1812, then followed by the Crimea War with France and England attacking the Russians, which the Russians lost that, followed by World War I, where Russia faced again invasion from Germany, and then World War II, another invasion from the Nazis, followed by the, you know, United States and Western intelligence launching covert wars against the Russians, starting, you know, in the late 1949, 1950, and it has continued off and on over the last 50 years, 60 years. So, you know, it's something the Russians are, you know, they're accustomed to dealing with this, and they take it seriously.
I was wondering, can you get, looking back at the recently in late May, Ukraine had struck the Russian missile in early warning sites. You know, it didn't seem like a natural target for the Ukrainians, I don't think, but I know it could be a target for the U.S. But U.S. and NATO are technically not at war with Russia. So how do you read the Russians, or how do you think the Russians are reading this tactic?
Well, I think the reports of those attacks were more of a Ukrainian, a joint Ukrainian-Western intelligence psychological operation. It was an information operation because, number one, the Ukrainians really didn't have a weapon like the ATACMS that could reach that far. So reportedly, this was attacked by a drone, and yet the picture, the only picture that was ever shown, looks like it was photoshopped. that advanced, that radar in Voronezh, where it's located, there were lots of people around that could have, you know, put photos on social media. Nothing showed up. The second attack in Orsk, again, with a drone, where the drone was, you know, shot down outside. So this was a dangerous move by Ukraine and the West. It's almost as if they're trying to provoke Russia into overreacting. And Russia didn't, because these strategic radars are designed. There are six of them, and they're designed to provide an early warning of intercontinental ballistic missiles. The Ukrainians claim damage that I think has not been verified by any kind of overhead photography or any other photographic evidence. But nonetheless, it underscores that Russia is in a position to use tactical nuclear weapons, and where could it use it, for example? If as the reports published yesterday, day before yesterday, that the F-16s are going to be deployed into Romania and then will be used in Romania to launch attacks on Russian positions in Ukraine and in Russia, the Russians could very well take that out with a tactical nuke. It would be a nuke that would actually probably three times the size of what destroyed Hiroshima. Now, they're only going to do that as a very last resort, but they're not going to sit back and let the United States build up a presence with weapon systems that have the capacity to carry missiles, nuclear tip missiles, that could strike inside Russia. They're not going to give the West the benefit of the doubt anymore.
Well, if we are moving, it sounds like, I mean, we continue escalating, and I mean, we're moving closer and closer effectively to World War III. And I don't know if it's something that could break out accidentally or deliberately, but in your view, what compared to where we are now, what additional steps have yet to be taken before it becomes official? And what yet has to happen before either Russia or a NATO head, you know, threatens their opponent directly?
I think what we see before that happens is the first sign would be if Russia now starts shooting down U.S. Predator drones in the Black Sea or U.S. surveillance aircraft, aircraft is known as rivet joint. If they shoot those down, then that's a clear sign that, hey, this is going to be moving to the next level. Similarly, if they decide to take out satellites, critical military, U.S. military satellites, that would be another move towards, take us closer to a step towards war. Here's the problem, Mike. The West does not have the military, the troop strength, or the reserves with weapon systems to pursue a war against Russia. It simply doesn't. And NATO itself is particularly weak in this regard. We've already had Turkey signal that they are they're not going to participate in any kind of action towards Russia. Well, that's critical for NATO because Turkey represents the second largest army in NATO after the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of this, you know, chest thumping and tough talk and belligerent threats from the West. That reminds me a lot, you know, if you've ever been at a bar and there's some really drunk guy threatening to kill, you know, beat everybody up, but he can't even get out of his chair, can't even walk a straight line. That's the situation we are with the United States and the European allies.
Joined us. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and I'm interviewing Larry C. Johnston. He's a CIA analyst, and he's a former CIA analyst and State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. And we're talking about basically the United States and NATO and Russia waltzing ever closer to a nuclear conflagration. Larry Johnston, just last week, you were in St. Petersburg in Russia.
Correct.
You were participating in the 27th St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, right?
Correct.
Did you speak to or hear from any senior government officials there?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I asked, I asked directly about, I got indirectly from Alexander Dugin. So Dugin is quite famous as a leading philosopher. You know, he's been called Putin's brain. That's an unfair characterization. But Dugin is well plugged into the decision makers in Russia. And, I was sitting across the table from him and Maria Zakharova, the spokeswoman for the foreign ministry. Mm. And I asked specifically about the change in rhetoric, the change in tone that I was hearing from Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Lavrov and others. And it was confirmed that there's been a definite change. The I would liken it to that scene in the movie Network, where the anchor, who in his total frustration and rage, encouraged the audience to open their windows and yell out, "I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore."
The Network. That,
yeah, the Network, and that was sort of the. I think that's where the Russians are right now.
Wow.
What's fascinating with the West completely stayed away from this International Economic Forum. Mm. There were 136 countries represented. There were over 25,000 people there. It ran like a Swiss watch. It was so well organized. So well put together, attention to details. And what it is a reminder that China, Russia, India, Brazil, South Africa, they're busy building an alternative financial system that is going to exclude the West. It's not going to be dependent upon the West in any regard. Already, and most people in the West don't pay attention to this. If you look at gross domestic product measured in terms of personal purchasing parity, what they call PPP, and all that means is, hey, you take your money, you take your U.S. dollars, you take your Canadian dollars, you go out on the economy, how much are you going to pay for a hamburger? How much are you going to pay for a carton of eggs? How much are you going to pay for a car? What's it going to cost to go to a movie? What does it cost to buy a new iPhone or a new cell phone of some sort? Okay, and when they measure it in terms of what you can buy with your local currency, right now the top four countries in order are China's number one, United States is number two, India is number three, and Russia is number four. So right off the top, the number one, number three, number four economies in the world measured in GDP have combined to oppose the United States. Mm-hmm. Germany and Japan have fallen behind and are continuing to fall behind and decline Russia. So the West had better wake up, because what was evident, Russia is not just flexing military muscle in Ukraine and working to destroy the Ukrainian military. Russia is building an economic alliance that is going to cover the global South. It will be, I think it will be the dominant economic power, really, for the remainder of the century. That's where it's headed.
Wow. Yeah. I know that your colleague Scott Ritter had planned to attend the same forum and
Right.
presentation, but he had his passport taken away when
Correct.
the plane. So I mean, I wasn't able to get in touch with him myself, but maybe you could say a few words about him and how the war is also coming at the risk of not only of the people in Ukraine or people in the battlefield, but also of American citizens, certain American citizens losing their rights.
Yeah, this was a deliberate provocation by the Biden administration. So they issued the Biden administration, State Department, Antony Blinken's domain, issued a passport to Scott 2 years ago. Now, Scott has a criminal conviction in his past. Because of that criminal conviction, the two things are supposed to happen. There's supposed to be an identifying marker in his passport to that effect. And he has to notify State Department 30 days, 28 days before he travels out of the country. Well, Scott has done that. He's traveled to Russia twice in the last 2 years prior to this. And each time he notified State Department, and the trip was allowed to go off without any problem. State apparently, for whatever reason, realized that the passport didn't have the proper marking, that they State Department had screwed up. They were the ones who made the mistake. And instead of acting like normal people, where you say, "Hey, Mr. Ritter, we made a mistake. We need to take your passport back and reissue you a new one." They made a big show of it because Scott was going to go to this International Economic Forum. And what was so stupid about it is, if Scott had gone to that forum without this attack on him by the Biden administration, he would have gotten some coverage, but it was nothing like what he received as a consequence of that. It got widespread news coverage, particularly outside the United States. And that doesn't, all it does is further reinforce the image of people outside the United States that we're a bully, that we don't respect the law. That we're all about force and coercion.
And he got a chance to talk to the audience and to participate by video anyway, right?
Right, he did it. He did it. It was I don't know if it was over Zoom or Skype or whatever, but he was up at 3:30 in the morning, because the session, as I recall, was started at 10:30, and in St. Petersburg, so there's a 7-hour difference between where Scott lives and where the session took place. But actually, I attended that session and saw him, and he did a fine job.
Yes, there's one more question I'd like to ask you. I mean, while you were in St. Petersburg, there was most of the media attention in the United States and Canada was on the 80th anniversary of D-Day,
Yeah.
just that last Thursday. And I mean, they were saluting the veterans for their service, but also they had this president, so-called president Zelensky, because I mean, he didn't get the actual run in the last election. They canceled and so on. But
Right.
he's currently serving as the president, okay? Being hosted, and Putin was, well, sorry, Zelensky was embraced by one of the veterans who hugged him, and so it was kind of odd, seeing someone who put his life into fighting the Nazis, treating this fellow who's working with the Nazis,
Yeah.
as a hero. But what do you make of that? I mean, is that an part of an attempt to actually rewrite history?
Well, the United States and France can try to pretend all they want what happened in World War II was different than what they're claiming, that it was the West that triumphed over the Nazis, that Ukraine was somehow fighting, as the in your own country, in Canada, you had people introduce that former Nazi member of the SS Waffen battalion as fighting against the Soviets in World War II. Well, that was exactly right. He was part of the Nazis. The Soviets were the ones who beat Nazi Germany, not the West. The West helped, but it was the Soviets, and particularly the Russians, who fought 80% of the German army during the course of that war, 80%. And it was the Russians who suffered overwhelming casualties compared to the West. You know, in the United States, by contrast, the Russians lost 16 citizens for every 100 people in that war, whereas the United States lost a fraction, basically a tenth of a percent in the battle in Europe of all of its casualties compared to its population. So, you know, for when you compare 27 million to 450, or actually in the European theater, it was like 225,000, because there was others that died in the Pacific. So not even a comparison. And it really was a low-class move by the United States. At least Macron had the grace to invite Putin, recognizing that you know, that battle against Nazi Germany was, it was a joint effort by the United States, by Britain, by then Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin. But the ones who bore the brunt of the burden of the war and defeating the Nazi army was the Soviet Union. And to not even acknowledge that and pretend otherwise. And then, as you correctly note, here's Zelensky modern day embracing the Azov battalion, the right sector. These guys are sporting Nazi tattoos, swastikas, SS, you know, the Toten, the death head. And they embrace Mein Kampf. You know, they're Hitler aficionados. And that's who the West is aligning itself with. You know, that says that says volumes about the moral degeneracy that has taken hold in places like the United States.
Well, Larry, I could see why you're disliked by some people, both on the left and the right, for your views. But I certainly do thank you for sharing so much of your analysis and experience with our listeners.
Hey, Michael, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for the courtesy.
We've been speaking to Larry C. Johnson. He is a veteran of the CIA and State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. His website is sonar21.com.
To those of you listeners in Western Canada interested in attending Eve Engler's event, June 14th, he will be in Kelowna, BC at 7 p.m. at Central Okanagan United Church Hall at 721 Bernard Avenue. On June 15th, he will be in Calgary, Alberta at the Community Wise Resource Center. Then on June 19th, he will be giving a talk in Regina, Saskatchewan at 3 p.m. And finally, on June 20th in Winnipeg, he will be at the University of Winnipeg in the Hive next to the Ellis Avenue entrance at 7 p.m. That is our show. Tune in next week for a special episode devoted to Indigenous peoples issues on National Indigenous Peoples Day. Don't miss it. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.